Today is Friday, February 20th, 2009. This is The Principles of Suspense, Life, the Universe, and Everything.
We're about to get started here.
I've heard good things about it, though.
This panel's called, what's it called? Something about suspense. Principles of suspense, there we go. And I'll let them introduce themselves in a moment. Just wanted to remind everyone to register at 3252 if you haven't already. And the Writing Excuses podcast has been moved to room 3224, and it'll be at 2 o'clock.
Oh.
So, whoever's running this show.
Shoot, I'm going to be here all day.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Howard Taylor, and I've nominated myself moderator for this panel because I don't know much about suspense. I know a lot about humor. I'm going to do my best to direct the discussion among these notables, and I'm going to begin by allowing them to introduce themselves, starting at that end with Brandon Mullen.
Hey, I'm Brandon Mullen. I write the Fablehaven books, Fablehaven series, Candy Shop Board. I actually on the program. I'm supposed to be in a different room, but since I'm also talking about middle grade, like, it would have me doing middle grade twice in a row. That's boring to me, and I was told to do suspense. So here I am doing suspense. I'm awesome at it. You're gonna learn so much. I'm awesome.
I'm James Dashner, and I'm the author of The 13th Reality, book 2 of which is just coming out right now. And The Maze Runner, which comes out this fall. And I'm a very suspenseful man.
I'm John Brown. I'm a new author. I have my debut novel is coming out in September by Tor. It's the first of a trilogy, an epic fantasy trilogy. It's called Servant of the Dark God.
My name's Howard Taylor. I'm a cartoonist.
My name is Dan Wells. I have a horror trilogy coming out. This is the first book. It's called I Am Not a Serial Killer. It doesn't actually come out for 3 weeks, though, because we wanted to build more suspense.
My name is Baron Stevens. My debut novel is coming out sometime summerish this summer. It's a science fiction fantasy action comedy. By day, I'm a musician, if that makes sense.
Hi there, I'm Roger White, and I'm a new author, and I have worked on a series called The Honeycomb Comet, which features the HX aliens, and that's out on my website on whiteworld.com.
Okay, let's kick this thing right in the head with a very simple question from panelists. Try and keep your answer short and pithy. What is suspense? We'll start with James.
That may be the dumbest question I've ever gotten on the panel. Suspense. That is actually a very deep and good question. Suspense, to me, is not so much summer blockbuster movie type suspense, but things that make you anxiously want to turn the page, make you fear for the character that you have fallen in love with. It doesn't necessarily have to be a chase scene. That's my answer.
Dan?
Suspense is making people wait for something. Alfred Hitchcock used a great definition where he says a bomb goes off, that's action. When a bomb does not go off, that's suspense. But you know it's there. You see it under the table, and you know it's there, and then you listen to people talk about baseball for 10 minutes, knowing that sooner or later the bomb's going to go off, and it becomes the most suspenseful, unbearable conversation about baseball ever. Jaws is another fantastic example of this. Every time someone gets in the water, they get eaten by a shark. And then Richard Dreyfuss jumps in the water. At night, next to a boat where someone was just eaten by a shark. And it is so scary, even though nothing happens, because you're waiting for it to happen.
Brandon?
One way you can look at a book, one way you can break it down, is as a system of tension and release. You create tension, you build up tension, and then you release the tension. The tension part is the suspense part.
Roger?
Yeah. Basically, as a reader or as a viewer, you're waiting for something to happen. You know it's going to happen. And while you're waiting, why, that's the suspense.
John?
I think it's important to realize that we read, one of the primary reasons we read is to feel suspense. And we can feel suspense about a lot of different things. If you look at a story, a story is about a problem. And there's some kind of danger or threat or lack or mystery. And what keeps us turning the pages is our just natural curiosity, wanting to see what happens.
I like what Brandon was saying about tension and release. I guess my approach to it was I basically shoot for at the end of each of my chapters to either have a cliffhanger or a punchline. Of course, punchlines don't add to suspense, but you know, at least they hopefully will get you to go to the next page.
And that's why I'm moderating.
The way I could tell if I was successful though with my my cliffhangers or with the ends of my chapters is what I put them out. One of the nice things about writing young adult books is I have three guinea pigs in my house, and I have them read the chapters as I wrote them, and if they screamed out "Dad" at the end of the chapter, I knew it was successful.
I just kind of want to say something about what suspense is not. Because sometimes we look at suspense and we think that, and I've seen this with a lot of stories where they think they're building suspense by making things not clear. I don't know what's going on. I have no idea. And they're purposefully making it opaque. And that is not suspense. That's just confusion. With Dan's Alfred Hitchcock example, you have to know that the bomb is there. It can't be a question in the reader's mind of what's going on. You have to have very clear threats, very clear dangers, and the only thing that's left up to the imagination is what's going to happen. That's suspense, but suspense is not confusion.
Yeah. Dial M for Murder, suspense. Cloverfield, not suspense. Not suspense. Okay, let's have another question here. First of all, I didn't sense any real disagreement in the panel.
You're wrong.
Perfect. I'm hoping that by the end of this, it will be like Jerry Springer, with the chairs and the bandages on the faces and all that. There we go. So next question. If we've identified what suspense is, how do you best like to do it? Not necessarily how you best do it, but how do you personally, as a writer, best like to do it? Dan, you're already holding a microphone. No, you put it down. Pass that down. Roger, how do you best like to do suspense?
Basically, what has to happen is that your reader has to know something's coming. So what you do is you set up the situation.
Now, how do you do it?
That's how I do it. I set up the situation, and there's an answer coming. But what is the answer? That's the time of suspense. So as a writer, I set up a situation, and the one that comes to my mind from one of my stories is you've got a bunch of guys sitting in a space capsule on Neptune. Who here has been to Neptune? Plans on going. There you go. You're not going to get there without some high tech. These guys are down looking for gold. It's not gold in my story, it's something else. But they're blocked. The gold's over there. They're over here. How are they going to get to the gold? That's suspense.
Okay.
Man, that's, for 2 minutes, I still couldn't think of anything. I've got something. Brandon, you go.
Me go? Go? Okay. We're getting specific, so here's an example. In Fablehaven, there's this character named Seth in Fablehaven 2, where he's got to go to this grove of trees, there's this creature, Revenant, that's in the grove of trees, and it's this creature that frees with fear. He's been there once before. We know what's in the grove. We know what's there. And so as he goes back, things that help the suspense build is you know that this creature's in the grove. You know that it's unbeatable. He's got this small hope. He's got some potion that's supposed to help him have enough courage that the fear won't freeze him. But you don't know if it's going to work. And so the reader starts with doubt in mind, and then it helps that the creature is very slow. And so when you have a slow threat approaching, that just ratchets it up and makes it worse for me versus, you know, a fast threat approaching, get ran into him. So drawing it out, like knowing it's coming, and then once it comes, drawing it out, that helps suspense.
My book is about a teenage sociopath who thinks he's turning into a serial killer. And he is basically wrestling constantly with his dark side. And he has a conversation with his therapist at one point in the book where he talks about, he says, people aren't afraid of what's going to happen to them because that's nothing they can control. People are afraid of what they're going to do. And that is my favorite kind. That is what this my whole series is about, is what is this guy going to do? There's external threats, but most of the suspense is this guy actually going to fall apart? Is his dark side going to come out? Is he going to fall? Is he going to break that next rule and justify that next little thing? And it just becomes very suspenseful. That's, to answer the question, that's how I like to do it, is to keep it all inside of that character's head. What is he going to do?
So what happens? You're killing me!
Good one. Brandon helped me by giving a specific, so I'll give a specific. My book, The Maze Runner, the scene my agent liked the most was this whole chapter where a character is on this stone wall. He's climbed up the wall. He's hiding in this ivy. And the whole chapter is just slowly explaining to you that these creatures that live out in the maze are coming. It's describing their noises, their sounds, these weird lights. It explains the vines are getting tight on his arms and stuff. He's tied around his arms. And it slowly builds and builds, and the creature gets closer and closer. Then it comes to the wall. It's right below him. And this whole chapter is almost agonizing because nothing's really happening, but you know something's about to happen. And then the chapter ends with, and then it started to climb the wall or something like that. And so the next chapter is pure action because everything goes crazy then. That's how I like to do it.
Like I was saying earlier, I like to end a lot of my chapters with cliffhangers, and so that's just kind of the pattern that my novel falls into as I build up towards the end of the chapter and just try to leave it right at the peak of the action. And I guess, you know, so hopefully people will go to the next page. But then it kind of, after it builds up the tension, then the beginning of the next chapter is kind of the release. So, you know, give people a chance to catch their breath or go to the bathroom, whatever they need to do, and then build it back up again towards the end of that chapter.
Something that, in addition to what's been talked about here, of course you have to put in the reader's mind some type of threat or some type of opportunity. If it's a love story, we're looking at an opportunity, right? But something that I like to do as it progresses is you get to a point where the hero or the main character has a plan to deal with whatever it is. And there are two things that I find that allow me to ratchet the suspense up even more, because a lot of suspense has to do with uncertainty. We know something's coming, but there's uncertainty. And so in introducing some type of conflict and surprise is usually what takes suspense and allows it to continue forward. Because with the book, right, with the main problem, you've got to have suspense through the whole book, however many pages that is. And so that element of conflict and surprise that now the hero's plans, whatever they are now suddenly in shambles or have to be changed, or the nature of the problem changed. For me, that's something that I just absolutely love to do, and I love it when I read something and things change because of those two things.
I'm going to jump in front of you. One of the really important parts of suspense, and I apologize if you're in Sanderson's class because I said this last night, is leaving a lot of stuff open so that your imagination can fill in the holes. And my favorite example of this is Hannibal Lecter, Silence of the Lambs. Long before you get to him, there's page after page of description of how dangerous he is. They have to go down several flights of stairs to get to him. They have to go through several gates and pass all these security checkpoints. And they never tell you this is what he's going to do. But instead, your brain fills in, why do they have him under all this security? If he's behind a solid glass wall, why am I not even allowed to get close to it? And your brain makes that much scarier than any actual literal description could. And so by the time you actually get to him, he doesn't do anything scary, but you're scared of him because your brain has filled in all of those gaps and said, he is a guy you need to watch out for.
I forgot to add the takeaway point to what I said. So I had the chapter of suspense, or yeah, chapter of suspense, and then a chapter of action. Well, my agent and my editor pointed out and actually helped me make this book better because they both agreed that the suspense building chapter was much stronger than the crazy action chapter. And so we applied that philosophy or whatever to my big climax at the end of the book. And we actually kind of pulled back a little bit on the action, and I purposely created some more things to build that a type of suspense that was similar to that scene earlier that they liked so much.
Let me add something here because it occurs to me that I actually have something to add. One of the viewpoints you can take as you're writing novels is a third person limited. A great way to build suspense is to switch to the perspective of someone who is going to do something awful. You don't know exactly what it is, but you know that they are capable of doing something awful. They have method, they have motive, they have opportunity. You don't see all of it. And then you switch away and innocently go to the discussion of baseball or something else. So that's one of the things that Third Person Limited is really, really good for, is giving you a brief insight into the mind of the monster that's lurking around the corner. And then, as has been pointed out, while you are busy telling the story of the conversation about baseball, the reader is busy telling themselves the story of, what's that thing doing around the corner? Because I know it can do this and this and this and this, and why is it still waiting? And that suspense, once you've captured the reader's imagination to the point that they are telling themselves the part of the story that you don't really need to tell anymore, they're telling it more effectively than you are, and you've scared the pants right off of them. Let me ask another question for the panelists, and this is a fun one. This maybe here we'll get some arguments. Tell me about suspense done wrong. Tell me about when it breaks. Tell me about failure to maintain suspense. Who wants to go first? Go, Dan.
Okay, Hannibal Lecter again. If you have read any of the later books in his series, the suspense is really dead at that point. Hannibal itself, the one that comes right after Silence of the Lambs, at that point, he's not hiding Hannibal Lecter anymore. He's putting him all out there. The book is full of blood and gore, but there's no shadows, there's no darkness, there's no mystery, because everything is right on the page. It's not suspense, it's shocking, and it actually makes it a lot more boring.
Yeah, like kind of like maybe like harmonizing with that. Action is kind of the opposite of suspense. Action, you know, if we're thinking tension and release, action is the release. And so if it's all action, it's also no suspense. Yeah.
Which is why a lot of times the summer blockbuster type movies start to bore you, because it's just action, action, action.
I was going to go out to YouTube for my example. And who has seen a sort of an average suspense on YouTube? And what happens? Somebody walks, somebody drowns, somebody walks, somebody drowns, somebody walks, somebody drowns. It goes on too long. One of the big problems with suspense is trying to carry it on much too long.
Aaron, you got
an example? Well, I know this might be a little bit controversial. Just one of the things I found for suspense to work, though, you have to care about the person that's in the situation. And the example I thought of, or not example, was, and I know a lot of people like this book, but I only read the first Artemis Fowl book because I hated the main character. I wanted someone to take his scrawny little neck and so I was rooting for the antagonist in that one.
Here's one if I can get somebody on the panel.
Thanks, Simon.
I loved a lot of things about the latest Batman movie. There were a lot of things I did that just didn't work for me. And one of the things was Batman's relationship with his girlfriend. There was absolutely zero suspense for me on that. There was absolutely no feeling. And so when this big situation came up, it was robbed of all of its effect for me. There was a lot of sound and fury in that movie for me, but not a lot of suspense. I will say. So the issue is, and the issue with this, and this happens with, it's surprisingly, too many Batman movies. There was the one Batman movie where we had 50 characters in it, and the same thing happened with this one. There was absolutely no development. In order for me to feel suspense, just like Baron said, I have to care about the character. I have to see a lack or an opportunity. I have to see some significant threat to happiness. And I never saw that with Batman. If he lost her, I really didn't care. There was nothing about that situation that made me say, no, you must get together with this girl. So for me, that was a failed opportunity for suspense.
Yeah. Talking about the Batman movie, the reason that I didn't feel much suspense, I felt lots of tragedy when she died. She dies. The reason there isn't any suspense is because going into that movie, you know, Batman can't be happy. This cannot end well. And it's, if you're at all familiar with the Batman genre, or even with the broader genre of this kind of film, you look at her role and you say, yep, she's going to die in Act 3. Yeah. Now, one of my examples... She couldn't become Batgirl.
Had a strained relationship.
This did not look like the sort of franchise that was going to launch Batgirl. For me, one of the best examples and worst examples of suspense is the first 5 minutes of any CSI episode. Okay, and it illustrates, I think, all of this. The only element of suspense there is the viewpoint character going to find a body or be a body? That's really all it comes down to. Yeah, Law and Order is the same way. I mean, and once you boil it down to that, you wonder, well, can there be any suspense? Some episodes, there is. And usually it's because you are identifying personally with that character. That person is a lot like you, and you think, I would really hate to find a body or be a body. I don't want to know what happens. Sure, go, John.
I just want to make a comment about that. Usually, though, in the beginning of a story, suspense is not... I mean, you can build it in the beginning of the story, but a lot of time what you're trying to build in the beginning of the story is curiosity. And so having somebody, an inciting incident like that, all we're trying to do is raise questions in the reader's mind to make them say, huh, I wonder, I want to get a little bit more about that. So sometimes, depending on what the purpose
those
is...
Those little teleplays, treat it as a little five-minute teleplay, it's almost got a three-act structure, but I'm not going
to... But what we're really talking about here is that you're setting it up. And there's a great phrase in our language called waiting for the other shoe to drop, which literally comes from a situation where a guy in an apartment, the guy in the apartment above him, every night would take off his shoes and he would drop one, and then he would drop the other, and then one night he dropped one, and nothing happened. And the guy went nuts. He wanted to find out what would happen. The other shoe, it's important that it's the other shoe, because you have to drop that first shoe in order to create suspense with the second. You have to prepare. You have to get your reader invested in the characters. You have to establish the situation. You have to establish the genre. In the case of these little five-minute CSI teleplays, you know, the preparation comes from the fact that you've seen these before and you know how it always ends, and you don't know how this one is going to play out.
Okay, we're going to open it up for questions here in about 5 minutes or so after one more pass through the panelists and questions. So be thinking, have something insightful to quiz us on, but it's going to be 5 minutes, so you can put your hand back. Next question, you mentioned genre, and I think it's important to bring that up. How has the genre that you write in affected the way in which you handle suspenseful situations? Go.
Okay, so I'm writing fantasy, Fablehaven, and
I think part of what's being affected here by my genre is just the types of problems that the characters are facing, hence the types of suspense they're dealing with. For my kind of books in a fantasy adventure, part of the suspense is like your big one at the end of the day is the world going to get destroyed? You know what I mean? Like, which is as big as it gets, but that's where fantasy sometimes goes to. Obviously, to make it matter, you have to care, is this character who I love going to get destroyed and their family and whatnot, you know? So often there's a life and death element when you're dealing with fantasy. You've got, you know, some dragon's going to eat them or some monster's going to do whatever. The other thing you have is, in fantasy, is the tensions of exploration. I love the tensions that curiosity can make. In fantasy, you can hint about these things or these creatures or these... And you can hint about them and leave the reader really curious about what is that thing or what is that place or what does that do? And those questions of when they're curious about a monster, they're curious about a place, or they're curious about a treasure, that's as you're creating tensions and releases, those tensions of making the reader wonder about what's around the next corner or what are the capabilities of a creature or wondering about the fantasy world, the curiosity of discovery, those are the tensions you're using to keep your readers engaged.
That's way too smart for me to follow up with.
Let John go.
I have to agree with Walt. I really think that the suspense depends on the problem or the mystery. And some genres allow some things that other genres don't. Like Robert Jordan, right? How many of his books did he introduce a character or a monster or talk about something, and then you don't hear about that thing for another book or two, hundreds and hundreds of pages. And I and other people that loved his books, while we loved them, just made that kind of stuff up. And that's allowable in fantasy. If I were to try to do that in some other genres, like if I were to write in a contemporary romance genre, the readers would be just like, what the heck? What is all this about? You know, they would want me to follow those things. Whereas so it's the type of problems that a genre allows, I think. And so that affects how I write.
Yeah, my example is actually kind of similar to that. I write a psychological thriller, is what this series is, and I wanted it to be very grounded in reality because I wanted the psychology of the character to be very important. But I also had a monster in it, a supernatural thing, and that the main character refers to as a demon. And so in order to make that work, I thought, well, first I need to ground this in the real world as solidly as I can, and then bring in the supernatural stuff later so that it will be all the more shocking and creepy when it shows up. And then in the very first paragraph of the book, I mention the demon. I say, a demon came to town, but we didn't know that yet. And then you go on, you get 8 chapters of normalcy. You keep waiting for the demon to show up, and it works very well. I think it's my book.
I think that pretty much summed up my thoughts. It's just that, I guess, for my own thing where I'm combining science fiction and fantasy, I can either have them eaten by a dragon or blown out of the sky in a spaceship.
So something horrible is going to happen. You just don't know what. Roger?
It's a challenge. I do mostly science fiction, and trying to stay within the bounds of what is set for the story and yet build the suspense and challenge is a lot of work in the writing part of it. What I do is work on human elements within the story, and sometimes I have to just add those human elements to try to bring the suspense to it. Once again, using my Honeycomb Common story as an example, we have a spacefarer who is traveling beyond Pluto. And he's out beyond Pluto. Well, what kind of suspense can you do with that? And the answer was, I gave him a family back on Earth. And I gave him some money back on Earth. And his family is trying to take his money. So the suspense is what is happening on Earth while he's busy off in the distance. That's how I handle it.
Let's open it up for questions. There's a question over here that I shut down 5 minutes ago. Go ahead.
Just about, you see, like, suspense is building up tension, and the release is like the action. Is it possible to have, even within like a thriller genre, to have too much too much tension, too much buildup, and not enough release? And how do you strike the balance?
Is it possible to have too much tension and not enough release? Is that the question?
Yes.
All right, let's field that, sucker.
Go, John.
Yes.
So how do you strike the balance?
Here's the thing. If you build something up for a long, long time, people want a big payoff. And if you don't give them a big payoff, it feels like a letdown. My wife and a number of other people have read a fourth book in a very, 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 very popular series. And there's huge buildup, and at the end, it's just too quick. So it's sometimes you need a long read. You have to address it.
I've actually got two examples of this. The first is a Dean Koontz book called Intensity. Anybody read Intensity by Dean Koontz? You know what? I read 30 pages into that, and I realized, boy, he's just never going to let up. And I flipped to the end and realized, yep, this is the same character in the same basic situation, and now it's being resolved. It would have been a miserable slog if I tried to read through the whole thing. And it was very intense. And I think that was what Koontz was trying to accomplish. And I bought the book, so I guess it worked. But I didn't enjoy the book, and I didn't read the whole thing. And the second example, and here I'm going to go back to my roots as a musician. When you talk about the laws of tension and release, in music, Western tonality, we talk about the law of the half step, which is when you are just a half step removed from tonic or from dominant, there is tension because the note wants to slide that last little bit into place. And that's why some chords, when you hear them, you think, oh, that's got to go to here. And when it does, you're happy. And when it doesn't, you think, oh, tension. Wagner wrote in Western tonality very heavily, and he abused that law in the same way that Dean Koontz abused My Poor Bleeding Eyeballs, by taking those half steps and instead of resolving, changing keys. And if you ever listen to Wagner, he does it for 20 minutes at a time, and then, to his credit, and the reason why he's a famous composer and I'm not, gives us the big finish. And you get those big epic moments in Wagnerian opera. So can you have too much tension? Yeah. Sometimes you can pull it off.
Okay, so I know I've used Silence of the Lambs as an example twice so far, but here you go again. You have to let the air out every now and then. You have to resolve that tension. And partly because the audience needs a little breather, partly because it allows you to build up to an even bigger freak out later on. Again with Hannibal Lecter. I told you all about how Clarice first meets him. And it's freaky, and he gets there, and then he doesn't do anything scary. And so we've had all that tension build up, and then it kind of starts, the air starts to bleed out of it. He's a nice guy. He's a very well-spoken guy. He's a very helpful guy. He likes her a lot. And then, 10 chapters later, when he finally does something really bad, it comes as a shock to us. Even though we were prepared for it, all that tension has kind of been bled out, and then we get shocked again. And so you can use those cycles of highs and lows to get even more scare and even more suspense out of your story.
For me, my personal philosophy is you have to have a broad mix in any story. Too much of anything becomes a monotone, and you get used to it and you get bored of it. And so, like, if it's funny for a minute and then it's tense, like that tension, it's like a peak to a valley or whatever. So that tension is, you'll feel it more, I think. So it would be the idea of too much of anything would be bad. Yeah.
Vera.
I guess kind of pulling from my own musical background as well. Of course, one of the things I do is I'm a jazz improviser, and one of the things I try to teach my students as well is not to, you know, give everything you got all right at the beginning of the solo and then and not let it up. And that's one of the things I think a lot of improvisers do wrong. And I think just part of the human nature is that our lives are tension and release. If we went through every day, every moment in total tension, the health consequences would be brutal. So
get some lithium.
Yeah. So I think in art, whether it's music or a movie or in writing, we need to be able to capture those cycles that we experience in daily life.
Just be careful. This doesn't mean that you should, when you're planning out your story,
say, okay, I got to have boring parts here and here. Okay? It doesn't have to get boring for it to be a release. It just has to, you know, there's...
Well, it's different. Contrast. Yes. Power of contrast. Not that I went from tense to boring, but I went from tense to funny. Funny's still interesting, it's just different.
My wife's got her hand up. That's going to take precedence.
I just wanted people to talk about, and there are writers who write for several different age groups. I certainly hope Dan doesn't give them those children. Young children.
I hang around outside of playgrounds.
But I would like to see, you know, there, how you do attention for children versus attention for grown ups. Is there a difference?
James,
do
you want to repeat the question for us?
She asked, how do you create tension for children versus tension for adults? Is there a difference?
You were holding the mic. You could have answered it. But no, you handed it to me, so I'm going to hand it to John.
Let me see the mic.
I said, you've got the mic. Repeat the question.
Before that, did you say that?
Yeah, but you weren't letting go of it, so
please don't fight.
I'm going to get a chair fight up here before the end of this panel, I think.
My only experience with the different genres is telling stories to my children and then writing stories for adults and teens. And I, for example, this summer, my girl, I live up in Bear Lake, and my daughter had a couple of friends over. And so they heard about the Bear Lake Monster, and I had this fabulous idea about what the Bear Lake Monster was. It wasn't some dinosaur or something. I told them about these children, that there were Indians that had legends, and they just had, there were children that disappeared. It was in the newspaper. And what they found were these markings that went out from these tall reeds out, and it was like these turtle steps or whatever, and they sent scuba people down. Anyway, so it got really, really, really scary for them. And I immediately knew I had to ratchet back. For an adult sensibility, I would have taken it and made it even a little bit more horrific. But for them, I had to take back. And then I had to say, after they sat there, and were just like, we're never going to the lake again. There's this witch, this mermaid witch that wants her children, and she steals children from this beach. You know? So and I was like, no, guys, it's just fake. Oh my gosh. You know? So for me, that's a difference, is how big a threat. How far can I take that threat and danger for children? For me, I can't take it as far. I just can't take it as far. They check out. My daughter checks out of stories when they take it.
Let's let James go so that he and I can make peace.
Shut your bowl. I don't really disagree with you, but... And I've never written a book for an adult, because adults are boring. But I can honestly say that when I am writing, and this is my favorite, by far my favorite part of writing stories is suspense and action and really cool stuff like that. I pull things back, maybe like language or gore or horror elements, stuff like that, because I know of my audience. But I never, ever... pull back on tension or anything like that.
Dan? Brian?
Do it. Okay. One of the main ways that you create suspense for adults is to put them in situations where they do not have control. As adults, we are accustomed to having control over what happens to us. And when we get put into a situation where we don't, then that freaks us out. Whether it's ironic tension, the reader knows that something's going to happen and the character doesn't, or whether it's a character who is trapped or a character who's being chased, whatever. When control is taken away, that is when things start to get scary and suspenseful. For children, that's the world they live in every day. They don't have control over their lives to a great degree. And so that kind of core principle, I would say there isn't a lot of difference in creating suspense for children and adults, because it's that loss of control over your own destiny that scares you.
And what I'll say is, on the tension or the suspense, I don't dial it down usually. Like for me, when I was a kid, what made me read a book was if it was cool and awesome. And cool and awesome equaled like scary and sweet and trouble and violence and all that kind of stuff. Like I don't dial up, like As a kid, I wanted stuff to blow up. I wanted people to punch people in the face. I wanted to see stuff happening that was cool and exciting. And so as a writer, I have to tone that down a little bit. I'm not just writing crazy, violent books. But as a writer, I remember that as a kid, I liked action. I liked that kind of thing. And in fact, frankly, without it, I'd get bored. And so I don't dial down the suspense. So on the tension part, I don't dial it down. I do dial down the release somewhat. You know what I mean? So like on the release, I'm not going to get like the brain matter on the wall. Just doesn't happen in my books. You know what I mean? Like you pull back on the violence. You pull the camera away a little bit on the violence. People still die, because if people don't die, eventually you figure out that no one's going to ever die in the books. And so people sometimes die in my books, and they're for little kids, and sometimes ladies that are sensitive, it's too scary for them. Like I know ladies that are adult ladies, and it's too scary for them. But I know lots of little kids who just eat up the scary parts. It's too scary for the most sensitive little kids, my books probably, but that's partly why adults can read my books and still have fun with them. And that's why a lot of kids give me big fat high fives, because I wrote a book that didn't bore them.
I think one of the big differences between adults and kids in terms of this is motivation. Children have much simpler motivations. If you have a monster, the monster is hungry, all the more reason to eat children. And that's really all you need at a children's level. That's when you get to adults, whether you have to say, oh, well, I need more motivation than that. So I think, again, one of the big differences is how much you need in motivation.
I'm not sure which question this is responding to, but an interesting thing I've learned in my writing career. My first four books were in first person. And so there's a lot of things that were fun about that. But it's been so fun for me to write the 13th Reality books, because I decided, which is a little unusual for middle grade fiction, that I was going to do it in third person and switch points of view between chapters and scene breaks and stuff. And that has been so fun for me, because it's a really cool way to create suspense when you can see several characters' viewpoint of the same situation. Whereas I could not do that in the Jimmy Fincher books. So, for example, if I'm walking down the hallway and it's in first person, I can't tell the reader that there's a serial killer named Dan Wells in the room at the end of the hall. I believe my pen speaks for itself. I am not. And actually, Howard did make this point earlier. But if you can switch point of views, and not always actually in the point of view of the serial killer. I don't really, and I do have the bad guy's point of view sometimes. It's just really fun to do it, and I've had a blast with that. In The Maze Runner, I went back to, it's third person, but it's, what do you call that one? It's the same character the whole time. Limited. I've gone back to the challenges I had with that first person. But and one more thing about structure can really create suspense, because it's why I used to love Tom Clancy. I don't know why I don't really like him anymore, but I used to love him. He just switches between point of views, and the pace was so fast, and he was... So you can use structure of not only just short chapters, but short breaks in chapters where you're kind of seeing different perspectives and everything is just building and building to a head where everyone's going to kind of collide.
Let's take one more question from the audience, and I'm going to pick Eric because his hand went up just a moment before yours did. I'm so sorry. Go, Eric.
Okay, a lot of writers seem to try to build suspense by withholding information that the viewpoint character knows from the reader.
Those idiots. Anybody disagree? Okay, the question was, many writers try to build suspense by withholding information from the reader, but it's information that the viewpoint character has.
Yeah, I learned, because I'm such a humble person, I'm going to tell you this, Eric. I learned a valuable lesson from my editor on my last book, because I kind of did that. I had, not throughout the story, but I wanted it to be a big revelation at this certain part of something this guy had done. Well, he didn't remember he had done it because he has all kinds of things wrong with his brain. But when he does remember it, I didn't have him reveal that to the reader yet. And it was a few scenes later where he tells the people. My editor said, there's no way we're going to let that happen, because as you're in this guy's point of view the whole book, when he finds it out, we got to find it out. So I fixed that.
There are cases where I've seen this done horribly wrong. And one of them, for example, is the Da Vinci Code. There's the character, I think her name is Sophie. whose whole job is to be the moron, and she sees a horrible thing early in her life in the past. She saw this awful thing that her grandpa did, and she knows what it is, and about 20 times she gets right up to the point of telling you, and then the scene cuts away or something changes, and it just becomes aggravating. You don't even care by the time she finally tells you, why didn't you just tell me before? On the other hand, I've seen it done very well. Sometimes the point of view character knows something and the reader doesn't, and it comes across really effectively. And so I guess I don't know how to tell you off the top of my head how to make it work. First of all, don't draw it out through an entire book like that. You know, if it's very brief and you do it right, you do it well, you keep your reader interested, then it can work.
Okay, we're going to wrap things up here with closing remarks, and let's start down at this end. Closing remarks, and if you want to make a shameless plug, be shameless and plug.
Two things. To building suspense, one is, again, that you need to let your reader know something's going to happen. But the other element that's very important is that your reader has to care. So before you can build the suspense, you have to build the care.
Again, yeah, my book is called The Dragon War Relic. It'll be coming out sometime this summer. I don't know exact dates yet. It's kind of kind of compared to like a Harry Potter getting a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Tolkien meeting Star Trek. it was a lot of fun to write. It's being published by Cedar Fort. I guess the other shameless plug, if anybody likes swing dancing, I'll be playing at the Murray Arts Center tonight from 8:30 to 11:30.
All right, very quickly, shamelessly plugging my book, I Am Not a Serial Killer. It will be available on Amazon UK in about 3 weeks, so please buy a copy of it. Also, very quickly, the Writing Excuses podcast featuring me, Howard Taylor, Brandon Sanderson, is in the very next room over here next hour. You are all invited. We're going to be recording 2 or 3 episodes live with an audience, so it'll be fantastic.
Well, I'll just wrap up for suspense. I just have to say this. If you're going to want to learn how to write, one of the key things that people go to stories for is suspense. So you've got to learn it. And tonight, I'm doing a 2-hour workshop as part of the symposium called The 3 Things You Must Learn to Write Killer Stories. We're going to be talking a lot about suspense. So, just want to plug that. It's tonight or 6.
I'm going to go with the shameless plugging part, because I like to shamelessly plug. That was supposed to be funny. You're supposed to laugh. Where's Sherry? Sherry's supposed to do me a courtesy laugh every time I say it. Thank you.
That was funnier than the joke was. I'm sorry. Good work.
Oh, man. I need to get over this thing of not caring to make myself an idiot in front of people. For the first time in the history of mankind, book 2 of my 13th reality series will be available at the BYU bookstore. It's not out in any other stores until next week. So, my signing's at 2 o'clock tomorrow. And my Maze Runner book, which comes out this fall, you could be the first person in the history of the world, except for a few people, to hear the first chapter, because I'm going to read that tomorrow at my reading, which is right before the signing, I think.
I forgot to say this, but I have a reading tomorrow at 2 o'clock, right on top of his signing. So it's a great war. We will be watching which side you choose.
I'm Brandon Ball. I write the Fablehaven. Fablehaven 4 comes out March 24th. I'll have a big fat launch party. It'll be a lot of fun. Fablehaven.com has all the details. Especially if you've got like 10 to 13 year olds in your life, get those guys reading it. If you haven't tried it, it'll take you on a good ride. It's that kind of book. And as far as like suspense, keep your readers curious. That'll keep them interested. And it's an art, not a science. Go with your gut. That's it.
For closing words, I'm going to quote the great Brandon Mull, tension and release. I mean, if you can think in those terms as you are writing, you'll get your suspense right, or at least write enough that your writer's group or whoever can help you fix it. My name's Howard Taylor. I've got a signing tomorrow. You can Google me and you can Google me at the signing too, I suppose. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been awesome. Thank you very much.